What is God doing? I can imagine that that question has been on many a Democrat's lips over the last few weeks as they wonder why was their Hillary rejected. But I wonder if that same question is sometimes on our lips as well. What is God doing? Why don't I have that wife or that husband or that girlfriend or that boyfriend that I crave? Like, God says relationships are meant to be a good thing. So why don't I have one? What is God doing? I told my buddies at school that I'm a Christian, and now they just mock me. I'm the center of every joke. What is God doing? I've been slaving away under this boss. I'm getting no respect, no acknowledgement. I'm an honest worker. Why is God putting me through all of this? Well, this same question, what is God doing, was the same question which would have been on the Jewish lips at the time of the letter of John. You see, Malachi, he was a few hundred years ago. God has not spoken clearly to his people for 400 years. The Jewish people, they're going to want to know, what is going on, mate? We're meant to be God's chosen people, under God's chosen rule and blessing in his chosen land. And yet here, we're in Israel, yeah, but we've been conquered by the Romans. This was not the reality that they were expecting. This was not the lives that they wanted to live. Where is their Messiah, which had been promised so long ago? Where is their Savior? What is God doing? Then the Jewish leaders, they hear a rumor, a whisper. Have you heard about this guy, John? What? No, John? Who's John? He's out there in the wilderness, baptizing and preaching. What? Who? No. Who's he? Well, why don't we go find out? Let's go. Let's go find out if this is the Messiah we've been longing for, we've been craving for. And so they go off. A small delegation into the wilderness to find out if John is the Christ. And this is where our passage begins. We've just had the author of the book's vivid introduction to who Jesus is, the great light in the darkness, the Word become flesh. But before we meet the main man, before we meet the central character, we're given this little introduction to John the Baptist and these Jewish leaders. The author of the book, he wants us to know two things. The first of those things is that the Lord is coming. In verses 19 to 23, the Lord is coming. The Jewish leaders have arrived in the wilderness and they want to know who John is. Let's have a look down at the passage together. Verses 19 to 23. Like, who are you? They ask. You can sort of sense a desperation there to know this man's identity. Even the very fact that that's the first question we're told about tells us that this is what it's all about, really. They just want to know who John is. This is the central question. Yet he confesses in verse 20, I'm not the Christ. Can you imagine how, like, devastating that would have been? They've got all their hopes and all their dreams. Is John going to fulfill it? And no, I'm not the Christ. Like someone saying to me, Adam, I'm going to buy you an Apple Watch. Really? Really? No. Crushed. But they still want to get to the bottom of this. They still want to know who he is. So verse 21, what about Elijah? Nope. He says, I'm not Elijah. Now, for some of you, you will remember that last week we said that John the Baptist was Elijah. Interesting. Does the Bible not stand up to credibility? No, nothing to fear. So Elijah never, John the Baptist never claims to be the prophet Elijah. He never actually thinks that his work is that important. It is Jesus who gives him that title in the Gospel of Matthew. So he's not Elijah. What about a prophet? They ask. Nope, he says, he's not a prophet. Verse 22, you can feel their desperation here because he's just not answering the question. Who are you? What do you have to say about yourself? Then finally, in verse 23, John tells us that he's not the finished product. He is but a messenger. He's but a messenger. I am the voice of the one crying out in the wilderness. Make straight the way of the Lord. John points. He doesn't point to himself. No, he points to the one who is coming. Look over there. He comes. He's nearly here. John is a proclaimer. He is a voice saying loudly and clearly, the Lord comes. Your God comes. Your King, he comes. Your Maker comes. The answer to your question comes. You're waiting for your promised Messiah. Well, oh, Jewish leaders, he's nearly here. Well, here he comes. Jesus is God and he is coming. John is like a fire alarm. He gives us warning that something is about to happen. He gives us warning that we need to act. Get yourselves ready, quick. Move. I've been a best man a few times now, and each time I've got to confess that actually my favourite part of the entire day is the moment just before the bride arrives. I love it. I get to be sitting there with my best mate. I get to be sitting there with all my other friends, and we just get to be chatting. It's easy. I've just got to make sure the groom doesn't leave the building. Job done. I've got no big job, no big responsibility. But then the vicar arrives and announces that the bride has come. And everything changes. Suddenly, we're all on our feet. Suddenly, the music is playing. Suddenly, I'm like, where are those rings? The news that the bride arrives changes everything. It has immediate consequences. I'm no longer relaxing. Action stations, people, we are go. The message John declares requires an immediate change in circumstance. For we're told not simply that the Lord is coming, we're told make straight the way of the Lord. We are to be like builders, building a pathway that the Lord can walk on. We need to get ourselves ready. Once the British government knew that they were going to have the Olympics in 2012, they had to get themselves ready. Volunteers had to be recruited. Stadiums had to be built. Opening ceremonies had to be produced. The nation prepared. The government prepared. The athletes prepared. Once they knew it was coming, they got themselves ready. John declares loudly to this Jewish delegation, make straight the way of the Lord. Now they have to act on it. We hear that same warning. We hear that same message. Make straight the way of the Lord. So are you ready? Are you ready for the Lord's coming? We live in a world of distractions. YouTube, Netflix, iPlayer, all four, iPhones, iPads, Apple Watches, iMacs. And when we're faced with a difficult decision, it's easy, isn't it? Well, let's just turn up the volume. Let's just ignore it. Let's just blot it out. Let's just do something else. But we cannot be distracted from this reality. The truth, even though it is hard to comprehend, it still must be dealt with. It cannot be ignored. Like that Jewish congregation, we too must act on the news. God has become flesh. The unknowable has become knowable. What is God doing? This is what God is doing. He is revealing himself in the man Jesus Christ. If you don't know Jesus as your Lord, then hear John's words. God has come to earth. We can often view God like that John Lewis advert last year, as that old man far away on the moon. And we have to like get our telescopes out and we have to try and hunt him down. We have to try and find him. And he's just distant. He's just lost in the stars, we think. But God isn't in the stars. We don't need a telescope to see him. Because God has become flesh. God is known in the person of Jesus Christ. So when we look at him, we see God in his fullness. So are you ready for God? Or are you just going to be distracted by the latest Netflix show? For this God, who said that he would come once to earth, has said that he will come again. He has said that he will come again to judge the living and the dead. We will all meet Jesus face to face. None of us can escape it. The Lord is coming. This is our final reality. Now, this Jewish delegation, considering they've come all this way to find out who John is, are you the Messiah? Are you the Christ? They don't actually seem to be particularly bothered by the answer. Instead, they just go on to ask John a few more questions. They just want to know what John is doing. Which leads then into the second thing that our author wants us to know. The Lord is worthy. The Lord is worthy, verses 24 to 28. The Jewish delegation, they want to know, why are you baptizing John? Verse 25. Then why are you baptizing if you're neither the Christ, nor Elijah, nor the prophet? Now you may think to yourself, that's a bit of a weird question, isn't it? Well, actually, baptism back then was a sign of religious authority. Through John doing these baptisms, he's making a statement about himself. He's saying that he has the authority to do them. But John bats it away quite quickly if we look in verse 26. Yes, I baptize with water, but don't you get it? Oh, stupid religious leaders, don't you get it? There's someone far more exciting than me who's about to arrive. There's someone who actually has real authority who is about to come. In verse 26, among you stand one you do not know, even he who comes after me, the strap of whose sandals I am not worthy to untie. The Lord who is coming, the one who we need to be ready for, he's going to come from among you. John is telling these Jewish leaders, he's going to come from the land of Israel. He's going to be born of a Jewish mother. He's going to be one of your own. He's going to be human. He's going to be flesh. And he's going to be so worthy. He's going to be so good. He's going to be so pure. That actually, in comparison, John is not even worthy enough to untie his shoes. He will not even be worthy enough to get onto his hands and his knees and untie his laces. He's not even worthy enough to get into the dirt and the muck and take off this man's shoes. Now, to understand really the depth of that statement, we need to grasp two things. Firstly, the disgraceful task of untying someone's shoes. And secondly, just how good John the Baptist was. So number one, untying someone's shoes. In that day and age, in that culture, in that time, feet were disgusting. It would have been really hot, it would have been really smelly, it would have been really sticky, it would have been really sweaty. Feet were rough business. And plus, shoes would have been even worse, because they would have walked through everything in these shoes, through the sand, through the dirt, through the muck, everything. The job of untying someone's shoes wasn't done by servants. The job of untying someone's shoes wasn't even really done by slaves. No, even the lowest of the low didn't have to do this job. They didn't have to untie their master's shoes. And here we have John putting himself lower than the low in comparison to how worthy the Lord is. John is not even low enough to untie his shoes. This has particular bite when we realize how good John the Baptist was. In Matthew's gospel, Jesus describes John the Baptist as being the greatest human being that ever lived. There's no one better, Jesus says, than John. He is the best of us. But John says, no, not even I am worthy enough to untie his sandals. See, this Lord who is coming, he is so high. And in comparison, I am so, so low. People have said that Nelson Mandela is one of the greatest men of our generation, but he is not worthy enough to untie Jesus' laces. People have said that Mother Teresa is one of the greatest women of our generation, but she is not worthy enough to untie Jesus' laces. Donald Trump would have us believe that he's one of the greatest people of our day. But even he with all his power, with all his celebrity and all his fame, even he is not worthy enough to untie the Lord's sandals. This is how low even the best of us, even the most powerful of us, are in comparison to him, in comparison to this coming Lord. We live in an age that wants us to claim that you're special. People wear on badges and put it on cards and cheesy posters. The L'Oreal advert got us for years saying, because we're worth it. You can now even buy a book entitled, Marry Yourself First, Say I Do to Passion, Purpose and Prosperity. We want to believe, don't we, that we're big deals. Why else would it be like so outrageous when we don't get the job that we want, or have the friends that we crave, or the partner that we think we deserve? These things are so offensive to us. We find them so hard because we do think we deserve them. We think that we should be the center of the world. Everything must, should, and has to go according to our plan. Now, one of the many joys of being a Christian is actually we're allowed to admit, I'm not special. I'm not worthy. Actually, I'm a mess. And actually, I've made mistakes. I don't even live up to my own expectations, let alone yours. I have moments of greatness, true, but I have moments of incredible weakness. I can be incredibly brave, but I have moments of real cowardice. I have moments of kindness, and I have moments of cruelty. And it's in this low state, it's in this unworthy state, that Jesus chooses to die for us. It's in this low state that Jesus chooses to carry our shame, to carry our sin, to carry our rebellion and nail them to a cross. It's in this low state that Jesus chooses to save us, just to prove to us how worthy and how great he really is. Like, don't you want a God like that? Don't you crave for a God like that? Don't you want to follow a God like that? Don't you long for a God like that? Well, in Jesus, we have one. We've got a God worth following. We've got a God worth knowing. A God who picks us up out of our shame and out of our disgust and raises us up. He takes us from darkness and he puts us into light. He takes us from being orphans and he makes us his very children. And that is the first bit of application we should take from this passage. Jesus is a God worth following, worth knowing, worth living for. And the second thing we should take from this passage is an attitude worth imitating, that of John the Baptist. Because he's saying here, more of Jesus and less of me. He's everything. I'm nothing. He's high. I'm low. He's the creator and I'm the created. He is the master and I'm the servant. Christ first, self last. What would it look like then to have a Christ first friend or a Christ first brother or a Christ first sister? Or a Christ first wife, or a Christ first husband, or a Christ first son, or a Christ first daughter, or a Christ first person. What impact do you think that would have upon our very lives? We crave relationships, job security, friendships, but do we crave them more than Jesus? Are we willing to put Jesus first and to turn down that job, which means you have to put aside your Christian principles? Are we willing to put Jesus first and turn down a relationship with someone who doesn't share our faith? Are we willing to put Jesus first and take the slack for it at school and in the office for being open about our faith, even if it does mean we lose a friend or two? We should not think of ourselves as special. Only Jesus deserves such recognition. Jesus first, self last. We should not think of this church as being special, with its fancy hall and its fancy program of events, with all its staff and all its wise members of the clergy, of all the people that come here, this church isn't special. Jesus is. Jesus first, St. John's last. Putting Jesus first, it's not going to be easy, but it is right. Putting Jesus first is going to be hard. I know that. I feel that. I live that. But we've got to do it one decision at a time. We've got to put one foot in front of the other in putting Jesus first. One prayer at a time, one day at a time. Glyn Harrison, the professor of psychiatry, helps us understand why this is so hard. We're creatures of status anxiety. We want the status, acknowledgement, the fame that we think we deserve. We don't mind if someone is wealthier than us until we find out it's an old school friend who's wealthier than us. Then it hurts. Then we feel small in comparison. Putting Jesus first, it's not easy, but it is right. Because we need to start living in the true reality. We cannot marry ourselves for purpose, passion, and prosperity. The world is not ordered like that. We need to live lives that acknowledge who Jesus is. We need to put him first because this is how the world is ordered. That is the true reality. Now, humility is not a highly honored virtue in modern society. Yet humility should be the aim of every believer. Tim Keller, in his small book, A Freedom of Self-Forgetfulness, comments on Christian humility. The essence of gospel humility is not thinking more of myself or thinking less of myself. It's thinking of myself less. It is thinking of myself less. C.S. Lewis shared a little story in Mere Christianity on humility. If we were to meet a truly humble person, Lewis says, we would never come away from the meeting thinking that they were humble. They would not always be telling us that they're a nobody, because a person who keeps on saying they're a nobody is an incredibly self-obsessed person. The thing we would remember from meeting a truly humble person is that they are totally interested in us. Jesus first, self last. What is God doing? It's a great question. It's a good question. And we should be encouraged to ask it. But while asking it, we have to acknowledge what God has done. He has come down to earth in the form of a man, in the form of Jesus Christ. He is knowable. We can know him. He is worthy. Worthy of our praise. Worthy of our very lives. So hear the challenge of John the Baptist and make straight the way of the Lord.